The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. Yo, 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 welcome back to Bitcoin Audible, hosted by yours truly. The guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. So, I was going through some stuff. I had a couple people DM me asking some questions. And one of them was about the energy production and the energy issue, quote unquote, with Bitcoin and around mining in general. And I was kind of shocked that I didn't quite have the episodes I thought I had covering this topic. I did have some good ones. Always great is Parker Lewis's Gradually Then Suddenly, Bitcoin Does Not Waste Energy. But I had read one sometime back and realized I'd never put it on the show. And this one's by Nick Carter. And it is titled The Last Word on Bitcoin's Energy Consumption. And it's not super long, but it's a really good one hitting a lot of the major fundamental disconnects just in the way of thinking about Bitcoin and its energy consumption. So we're going to go ahead and get right into it. First, let's throw some love to Hexawallet. Just got two new contacts in my Hexawallet and happily a keeper of part of their backup. It really is kind of a cool system that they've got with their Shamir secret sharing thing. So if you want to check it out and you want me to be a part of your backup or one of your contacts, always feel free to hit me up and ask any questions. And a huge thank you to Hexawallet for supporting Bitcoin Audible and making such a cool mobile wallet. Let's go ahead and get into today's article. Again, this was on CoinDesk, published back in May of this year. The Last Word on Bitcoin's Energy Consumption by Nick Carter. Much ink has been spilled on the question of Bitcoin's energy footprint. But amid the clarifying details and the energy mix calculations, we have lost sight of the most important questions. Anyone who wades into this muddy debate must consider the fundamentals before making a final assessment. Energy, a local phenomenon. Let's start with the basics. Many people, when decrying Bitcoin's energy footprint, point out its energy consumption and presume that someone somewhere is being deprived of electricity because of this rapacious asset. Not only is this not the case, but Bitcoin's presence in many jurisdictions doesn't affect the price of energy at all because the energy there isn't actually being used. How could this be? The first thing to understand is that energy is not globally fungible. Electricity decays as it leaves its point of origin. It is expensive to transport. Globally, about 8% of electricity is lost in transit. Even high-voltage transmission lines suffer line losses, making it impractical to transport electricity over very long distances. This is why we talk about an energy grid. You have to produce it virtually everywhere, especially near to population centers. When you consider Bitcoin's energy intake, interesting patterns emerge. New data from the Cambridge Center for Alternative Finance has confirmed what we effectively already knew. China is the epicenter of Bitcoin mining, with specific regions like Xinjiang, Sichuan, and Inner Mongolia dominating. With the cooperation of mining pools, the Cambridge researchers were able to geolocate the IPs of a sizable fraction of active miners, creating a novel dataset giving us new insight into Bitcoin's energy mix. And the results are revealing. Sichuan, second only in hash power rankings to Xinjiang, is a province characterized by a massive overbuild of hydroelectric power in the last decade. Sichuan's installed hydro capacity is double what its power grid can support, leading to lots of, quote, curtailment or waste. Dams can only store so much potential energy in the form of water before they must let it out, It's an open secret that this otherwise wasted energy has been put to use mining Bitcoin. If your local energy cost is effectively zero, but you cannot sell your energy anywhere, the existence of a global buyer for energy is a godsend. There is historical precedent for this phenomenon. Other commodities have been employed to export energy, effectively smoothing out ripples in the global energy market. Before Bitcoin, aluminum served this purpose. A huge fraction of aluminum's embodied cost is the cost of electricity involved in smelting bauxite ore. Because Iceland boasts cheap and abundant energy, in particular in the form of hydro and geothermal, smelting bauxite was a natural move. The ore was shipped from Australia or China, smelted in Iceland, and shipped back to places like China for construction. This led to an Icelandic economist famously stating that Iceland, quote, exports energy in the form of aluminum. Today, Iceland is hoping it can replicate this model with the export of energy via data storage. This is why smelters are located in places where electricity is abundant and where the local consumers may not be able to absorb all of that capacity. Today, many of these smelters have been converted into Bitcoin mines, including an old Alcoa plant in upstate New York. The historical parallels are exquisite in their aptness. So to sum up, part of the reason Bitcoin consumes so much electricity is because China lowered the clearing price of energy by overbuilding hydro capacity due to sloppy central planning. In a non-Bitcoin world, this excess energy would either have been used to smelt aluminum or would simply have been wasted. My favorite way to think about it is as follows. Imagine a topographic map of the world, but with local electricity costs as the variable determining the peaks and troughs. Adding Bitcoin to the mix is like pouring a glass of water over the 3D map. It settles in the troughs, smoothing them out. As Bitcoin is a global buyer of energy at a fixed price, it makes sense for miners with very cheap energy to sell some to the protocol. This is why so many oil miners, whose business results in the production of lots of waste methane, have developed an enthusiasm for mining Bitcoin. From a climate perspective, this is actually a net positive. Bitcoin thrives on the margins where energy is lost or curtailed. It's about the energy mix. Another common mistake energy detractors make is to naively extrapolate Bitcoin's energy consumption to the equivalent CO2 emissions. What matters is the type of energy source being used to generate electricity, as they are not homogeneous from a carbon footprint perspective. The academic efforts that get breathlessly reported in the press tend to assume either an energy mix which is invariant at the global or country level. Both Mora et al. And Krauss and Tolomat generated flashy headlines for their calculations of Bitcoin's footprint, but rely on naive extrapolations of energy consumption to CO2 emissions. Even though lots of Bitcoin is mined in China, it's not appropriate to map China's generic CO2 footprint to Bitcoin mining. As discussed, Bitcoin seeks out otherwise curtailed energy, like hydropower in Sichuan, which is relatively green. Any reliable estimate must take this into account. Silver linings. The prospects look even sunnier when you consider the changing nature of Bitcoin's security spend. 87% of Bitcoin's terminal supply has been issued already. Due to the path Bitcoin's price took during the heavy issuance phase, miners will have been collectively rewarded just over $17 billion in exchange for finding those coins, assuming simply that they sold their coins when they mined them. Even though the coins are worth $160 billion today. This is because most of those coins were issued at cheaper price points. If Bitcoin ends up being worth substantially more in the future than it is worth today, say by an order of magnitude, then the world will actually have received a discount on its issuance. The energy externality of pulling those Bitcoins out of the mathematical ether will actually have been very low due to the historical contingency of when, price-wise, those Bitcoins were actually mined. In other words, Bitcoin's energy expenditure may end up looking rather cheap in the final analysis. Coins only need to be issued once, and it's better for the planet that they be issued when the coin price was low, and the electricity expended to extract them was commensurately low. As any Bitcoin observer knows, issuance as a driver of miner revenue will decline with time. Last week's halving cut the issuance side of miner revenue by half. If I had to make a guess, Bitcoin's periodic halvings will at least offset its appreciation long term, making runaway growth in security spend unlikely. Fees will necessarily grow to account for a much larger fraction of miner income. Fees have a natural ceiling to them, as transactors must actively pay them on a per-transaction basis. If they become too onerous, users will look elsewhere or economize on fees with other layers that periodically settle to the base chain. Thus, it's unlikely that security spend results in the world-eating feedback loop that has been posited in the popular press. In the long term, Bitcoin's energy consumption is a linear function of its security spend. Like any other utility, the public's willingness to pay for block space will determine the resources that are allocated to providing the service in question. Is it worth it? Now, despite all the caveats listed above, it's undeniable that Bitcoin not only consumes a lot of energy, but produces externalities in the form of CO2 emissions. This is not under debate. What Bitcoiners are often confronted about is whether Bitcoin has a legitimate claim on any of society's resources. This question relies on a kind of utilitarian logic about which industries should be entitled to consume energy. In practice, no one actually reasons like this. The Bitcoin energy supplicants are mum when it comes to the energy used to illuminate Christmas lights, to power the data centers behind Netflix, or to distribute untold millions of single-serve meal kits. It's clear that because Bitcoin's footprint is so easy to quantify and an object of revulsion among the chattering classes, it is singled out for special treatment. Ultimately, it's just a matter of opinion as to whether the existence of a non-state synthetic monetary commodity is a good idea. The truth is that block space is a service which is paid for, and that's where its resource cost is derived. Something duly purchased cannot, by definition, be a waste. Its buyer derives benefit from its existence, regardless of anyone else's subjective opinion of the merit of the transaction. These same arguments have been made countless times about the perceived, quote, costs of the gold standard, and rebutted on similar grounds before. Fundamentally, millions of individuals the world over still value physical, bank-independent savings, so it still gets pulled out of the ground with regularity. As long as people value Bitcoin, so too will the block space auction continue in perpetuity. The Bitcoin energy warriors need not despair, however. There is a solution. All they must do is persuade Bitcoin fans to use and value an alternative settlement medium. Their best bet will be to devise a system that is even more secure, offers stronger assurances, settles faster, is more privacy-preserving, and is more censorship-resistant, all without using proof of work. Such a system would be miraculous. I'm waiting with bated breath. And that will do it. Nick Carter's a piece from Coindesk.com, the last word on Bitcoin's energy consumption. Now, there are a couple of really great fundamental points made here that just kind of show, he refers to it kind of as naive. You could damn near call it dishonest, but I guess it, you know, never attribute to malice what, you know, is easily explained through ignorance. But the idea that you can just take some generic footprint of what it costs and how much CO2 is produced by, you know, the energy in the U.S. and then be like, okay, well, this is how many watts Bitcoin uses, therefore, these are the consequences, and think you've got a you've got an honest perspective on what impact Bitcoin has. It's just absolutely absurd. That is literally what all of these papers and things, I mean, I've read a lot of these, and that's basically the generic process. Like, that's how they think about it. Or at least that's how the ones that, you know, get perpetuated through the media, because they boil the oceans and all that idiocy. Good for clicks and all that good stuff. But there are certainly better reports and analysis being done that do take an honest approach, or take a very realistic approach as to figuring out what the hell, you know, is going on, and at least admit where they don't have good data or where they are making some set of assumptions. But one of the key things that this article points out that I think really adds to the discussion, or is just kind of fundamental and can't be removed from the discussion, is that Bitcoin mining is almost never competing with retail use of electricity. Like it is not taking the energy that you're using to cook your food. Almost nowhere is that a profitable means of mining. In fact, sometimes it's multiples in cost for what you actually get out of it. And this is increasingly further and further from the state of the actual mining industry, the broader mining industry. I mean, you know, you might have, you know, home miners and stuff. And back when, obviously, it was CPUs, GPUs, and FPGAs, this was very common. But we're an entirely new industry, and the incentives and the trends are all toward exactly things like this. Like, why does China have dominance on mining? Why is most of the mining in China? Because of all this completely untapped, overbuilt hydroelectric power. That is why. So right off the bat, any standard assessment of China's CO2 footprint is ignoring the very reason China has all the Bitcoin mining, is because the power that it's able to access has nothing to do with the broader production of energy in China. It's exactly that energy that can't be used by anybody else because they're a giant centralized institution in government planning that is inept. The energy's just sent into the ground otherwise. And this is just what makes Bitcoin such a unique buyer of last resort, essentially, in the energy space. And why I think the incentives, or I guess the structure of the Bitcoin mining industry and the security of Bitcoin mining, is going to be far more an energy question in 5 years, 10 years, than it will be a who has the best ASICs or patents on the best hardware sort of thing. I think ASICs will become, and are becoming, commoditized to an extent. I mean, there will always be competition in that regard. I mean, hardware will never end, but there will be a point where incremental improvements, because it's simply a, you know, application-specific integrated circuit that does SHA-256, the improvements will become more and more minor, and it will slow down a lot. It already has slowed down, and it will continue to do so. And what will be far more effective in, I guess, predicting or influencing the Bitcoin industry is where energy is wasted. And I love that I never really thought about the fact that Nick Carter is always great for finding some of these historical parallels or these like alternative things that have basically fulfilled the same role in some like partial fashion. I'd never thought about the aluminum smelting, but what a great parallel of, you know, something where you can go to make use of a highly available, low-cost energy that can't get used in some other way, that doesn't explicitly need, you know, that is relatively geographically independent and temporally independent. It doesn't quite matter when you're producing or using it. You can use it when it's available and you're saving on costs. Whereas aluminum smelting isn't perfect in that regard, but it is definitely a better fit than a lot of the alternatives. But even that, to a degree, you can't just like cut off an aluminum smelter for extended periods of time and then just cut it on for a couple hours whenever, you know, you've got this whole crap ton of extra energy going on, and then cut it back off and, you know, expect to make a profit or think that it's really, you know, you can just let an investment of that size sit idle. And then he alludes to the fact, or talks about the fact, that they're, you know, trying to offload with data centers as well. You know, take the extra geothermal energy and essentially run servers. But again, this is also a really great use of energy that can't be tapped into some other way, or is just so distant from a society or some city or something like that, that it can't be reasonably transported. You know, like he said, there's a lot of waste in transporting energy over incredibly long distances. But not only waste, is that the far worse problem with transporting it such a long distance is the infrastructure cost. Like, if you find that there's, you know, 200 miles away from the nearest city, that there's a perfect place for a dam, or there's perfect, you know, really shallow geothermal energy to take advantage of, well, you can put, you know, you can build a mining plant or energy production a facility out there. But you, how many billions of dollars is it going to take to get 200 miles of infrastructure to the nearest city to actually reach your customer? I mean, that energy's damn near useless for a decade before you get that infrastructure built out to where the energy can actually be used. But enter Bitcoin and you've got a whole different game. Now you can actually sell the energy immediately to something that geographically doesn't matter anywhere in the world where you are. You can mine Bitcoin in Antarctica if you want. If there's an untapped source of energy, go. That's a great place to do it. You'll be by yourself and you'll have no competitors whatever. Don't even have to cool your machines. Just run some air through the building. Put a fan in the window. And the brilliance of this, though, like, of having Bitcoin as a tool in this way that is literally independent in all these different means, like geographically, in relation to when you are utilizing it. If the main business is producing energy, but then, you know, in the middle of the day, you're running at 98% load, and then in the middle of the night, you're cutting off generators and you're producing twice as much energy as can be used, and you're trying to adjust, which could take extended amounts of time to actually make those adjustments. And you can't just run at 99.9%, or, you know, a couple people turn on their stoves and now power's going out. You've always got to have extra capacity that can be cut on and off, or be accessible or requested, I guess you could say, on the network whenever, or on the grid whenever it's needed. So you have to have a buffer, but necessarily the existence of a buffer from what is being used between what is being used and what is being produced means wasted. And enter the ability to just plug up a bunch of Bitcoin miners and run them for even just 20 minutes. Like, you can basically have Bitcoin be the buffer. So rather than running the extra electricity into the ground, rather than just throwing it in the trash, you go to mining Bitcoin. You do not change your CO2 footprint in the grand scheme of things, and your energy grid is far more efficient, and you can provide energy at lower cost because it's always paying you. You don't have to throw it away anymore. This is that article. I was also not something I've read on the show, but there was an article about a New York. I don't think it was the Alcoa plant that was being referred to here, because it was actually an electricity plant in New York that literally set up a ton of Bitcoin miners as its buffer for this very reason. So that when they're having to produce, you know, they know, you know, it's getting hot in the middle of the day and load's about to increase by 10 or 15%. They go ahead and turn on that extra electricity ready to be needed by the grid and pump it into a bunch of Bitcoin miners in the short term. And then as soon as it's requested, shut the Bitcoin miners right off and feed it to the customers who need it. And the crazy thing is that there's really nothing that can fulfill this role as easily and as perfectly as Bitcoin mining can. This brings me back to, there's a great article, if you haven't listened to it. This one's classic, and it goes a while back on Grisha.org. The piece that I think I remember it was like Tales from the Crypt was talking about it some time ago. And I realized I'd never read it on the show, but blockchain is a decentralized or blockchain proof of work is a decentralized clock. And it's a really brilliant piece about how proof of work is actually a mechanism for telling time in a decentralized fashion. But one of the things that he points out in the piece is that proof of work is memoryless and progress free. And this is actually a characteristic of it that makes it explicitly so useful in this exact sort of purpose. This is why you can just flip it on for 20 minutes and you can make headway and you can flip it off. And it doesn't really matter that you had to flip it off at any time. If you can have a more productive or more valuable use of your energy in that span, it's not a bad investment if you always have the ability to turn it on. And progress free means that it doesn't matter when you turn it on. It doesn't matter if you do 10 hashes right now or 100 billion hashes right now or how long you run it. Any attempt to find a valid hash is helping the system, even if it's not broadcasting, because it doesn't matter. Every single thing, it's like a coin toss. Even if you're doing it on a piece of paper and you're just testing whether or not you can get one, if you produce a hash, you're contributing to the global universal hash rate. Because it doesn't matter how long anyone has been mining, the next hash is still equally likely for anyone to get it. And because the network is decentralized and it's not something that's like a service that needs to be met when someone needs it, because the system is designed in such a way that anybody, any amount of people can basically freely enter and leave the system at any time, is that like with a data server, I mean, imagine like this, you know, New York miner, or let's say, use the example of Upstream Data that I love to talk about because, and Nick Carter mentions it in this article as well, talking about how oil miners are always burning off a crap ton of like, you know, natural gas and methane, and it's basically wasted because they're mining the oil, but here's all this that they have to offload, which is a net negative. Like, it produces a massive amount of CO2 and other pollutants and stuff because you're burning something off, while something like Upstream Data is actually selling these essentially mobile boxes, mobile in the sense that they are just shipped and then can be plugged up and they can be, you know, shut down and shipped somewhere else in a relatively short period of time. And I think this will continue to get more and more commoditized. You know, you'll just have crates being dropped off, plugged in, here's a miner, et cetera, et cetera. But they're capping this. They're actually leading to or resulting in lower CO2 emissions because you have something that can actually take advantage of this. Otherwise, how the hell would you provide servers on Netflix whenever you just happen to be burning off a little bit of methane? It's like, is it 8 o'clock at night? I'm sorry, you can't watch your video right now because the server's down because nobody's burning off methane. None of my oil producers are burning off methane. You can't do that with a server, any sort of internet service, because it has to be there on demand. It's when the consumer demands it that you have to be able to provide it. And this is essentially true of almost any other use of the energy that you could think of. And Bitcoin provides such a fascinating new tool to take advantage of this, to basically be that buffer around so much wasted energy, or between so much wasted energy on the grid, that's too far away, that is renewable, that needs, you know, some level of infrastructure that cannot actually meet the investment needs. Like I've said before in a couple of episodes, or like as we've talked about this, is that going back to the example of something that's 200 miles away, is that, you know, it may very well be that they can't get any investment in building that because of the amount of infrastructure it would take to reach the consumer. So it just doesn't happen, because they're like, okay, so it's going to be 5 years and $2 billion to actually reach a consumer. And then after that, it's going to be another 8 years before we pay it off at, you know, this interest rate or whatever. And that's it. So like, we're looking at like a 13 year investment or whatever to actually turning our first profit. Yeah, no, I'm going to go elsewhere. But now think, they can build the facility out in the middle of nowhere and immediately start selling the energy to a buttload of Bitcoin mining machines. Just sell it directly to the network. And even better is if the halving happens and, you know, maybe Bitcoin appreciates and they can hold on to it for, you know, 4 years while they're building out the infrastructure, they might be able to turn a profit on their investment in half the time. This is even more true for something that doesn't give consistent energy, for something like solar or wind, which I actually think they're horrible forms of energy for a whole lot of other reasons, but just generically, they're also incredibly hard to take advantage of because the sun's not always shining when people want to use energy. The wind isn't always blowing. And it's not as if we can just plug in mountains of lithium-ion batteries to just store it. Energy storage is horrible. It's one of the most difficult problems to be tasked with. They almost always drain, and it doesn't even matter. Like, for the amount of energy that we use, we couldn't store it. It would take all the lithium on the planet. We'd run out of it in like a year or two. And the batteries, not to mention that the batteries are poisonous and toxic to the environment. It undoes the whole problem to begin with. Same with producing solar panels. They sound really great on their face. It's like, oh yeah, it's great marketing. We're just using the sun. It's like, oh, well, what about the toxic chemicals, you know, used in the waste produced in solar panels, like sulfur hexafluoride, which is 23,000 times as powerful of a greenhouse gas and toxic to boot. Yay, save the planet. I mean, so much of this discussion is just poisoned by politics that there's just not a reasonable discussion to be had about it. But the fascinating thing is that the presence of Bitcoin in the interplay in all of this and to behave as this buffer in place of terrible things like massive amounts of batteries, which just wouldn't happen because we're probably still decades of and many different iterations of improved battery and energy storage before that could ever be economical anyway. But regardless, Bitcoin is exactly the sort of thing that could fill the gap. And I just love the analogy that he put in this article that I had forgotten about until I came back to this, because it's such a great way to imagine the situation is that if you have a map, you have a topographic map of the world, and, you know, it's a 3D topographic map, and instead of, you know, being the mountains and the valleys or whatever being the high and low areas of the map, that it's the electricity costs. So where the electricity costs are high, you have mountains, and where the electricity costs are low, you have troughs. And adding Bitcoin to it, and, you know, commoditizing ASICs and having a widespread, highly competitive global market in this will be the equivalent of pouring a giant glass of water on this, and it will just fill in everywhere the price is low, everywhere the energy is wasted, everywhere that it can't be used for some other reason, everywhere it is not being competed for Christmas lights and ovens and aluminum smelting. In all of those places, Bitcoin will just fit right in. And because of those unique characteristics of mining, it can just simply be there whenever it is needed, and it can set up very, very quickly, and it can shut down and move very, very quickly. It's just so unique in that way that it's a huge, huge net positive for the environment and our energy production. But I think one of the major problems at the heart of the whole discussion is that just the very nature, just the statement that you are using energy for something has essentially become evil. Like the default is just like, oh, that's bad. We shouldn't use any energy. And this is a really anti-human perspective, in my opinion. Understand, there is no future where things get better and we use less energy. Maybe we use it more efficiently, or we find a better way to produce it, or we have a lot of new innovations, but there is no way that our lives get better by using less energy. That is the reason, that's one of the fundamental standards of how we could actually measure whether or not our lives are actually getting better. It's explicitly because the poor have no access to energy for all of their goods and services and to offload their tasks and do anything that they are poor. We can define them as poor as being unable to utilize all of the energy around them. The only way for to actually make people wealthier, to actually progress into the future, to actually innovate, to actually have us better connected and better able to trade and grow the economy is for us to use more energy. So to demonize the very act of using energy and just equating it with destroying things, I think is just a fundamentally wrong presumption. There just is no better future where that is the truth, that we use less. The only way forward is to innovate. The only way forward is to come up with better systems, to be more efficient and have something exactly like Bitcoin that can fill in all of our horrible inefficiencies. The LNLL, I still cannot for the life of me ever remember what that stands for. It was a report done that we read in, not going to be able to remember the episode either, that just kind of broke down where energy was lost. And, you know, like Nick Carter talks about in this, that up to 8%, is just lost in transit, that energy is just passively lost at the ends, where, you know, you just have things plugged in that just slowly drain. You have all these buffers where, you know, something is produced while it's not being consumed. You always have to have extra production on the grid so that if somebody turns something on, there is something there to give it power. Then renewables make this way worse. The solar panels are always producing energy regardless of whether or not people are using it. Windmills, like all of the highly disparate distant and natural energy sources are very, very high waste to actual use. So what was the assessment like of this report? Like where did they figure out how much energy was simply lost? Two-thirds of all the energy produced in the world and all of our systems and all of our grids, around 66% is simply lost. It's just run into the ground, unutilized, lost in transit, drained out arbitrarily. It's just gone. Which essentially means that, theoretically, the level of inefficiency in the world, in the global energy production and our global energy systems, the inefficiency is so great that it's actually possible that if Bitcoin could fulfill this role in a more and more micro manner with less upfront investment, and the Bitcoin system could continue to be profitable or continue to be in demand such that fees sustain it into the future, it's theoretically we could match, Bitcoin could match the entire world's energy consumption without us producing any extra energy. With no increase to the CO2 footprint, no extra pollution, nothing. Now, I don't think that's likely, and I don't even think the fees, the system is designed, Nick Carter's point towards the end is that, you know, this will eventually go to fees, reward will continue to decline. Like, this is not Bitcoin's future. It will simply be a market for security spend, and he could be right that it doesn't change a whole lot in the coming years as, you know, we get more halvings. It could very well stabilize, and it certainly won't give some feedback loop that will just boil the oceans and, you know, consume all the world's energy. Like, that's just silly. But it's interesting to think about the dynamic that all of the energy being used by Bitcoin right now could be 100% excess. It could all just be energy that was going to be lost. I mean, it's not. We know, like, just by assessing it, that's not the truth of all energy being expended or being used on Bitcoin. But in the realm of potentialities, Bitcoin is the one thing that could actually pull it off. So, anyway, I just always thought that was a really interesting concept, that there's just so much wasted energy that if we can just find something to take advantage of it, if we can source out that waste and put a Bitcoin miner between every imbalanced inflow and outflow, we could bring that number down. We could bring it from 66% to 50% of wasted energy. And that's phenomenal. You know, that's crazy to think that that's actually a potentiality of this. So anyway, really great article. I love thinking about this topic because, as I said earlier, I really think the discussion around Bitcoin mining is going to, already has, and will continue to accelerate away from a discussion about hardware and ASICs and chip density, and toward a conversation about energy production, about where energy is produced. And there may be a correlation, I guess you could say, or a relationship between a country's energy independence and their quote-unquote Bitcoin independence, where, you know, if this becomes a global reserve asset, you know, it may very well be boasting that, you know, I've got enough hash power and independent energy production in my country that I can settle my own transactions on the Bitcoin network. So it's just really cool to have the groundwork laid on how to think about this stuff. And gotta say, this is kind of the last word on Bitcoin's energy consumption, because it strikes at the heart of a lot of the criticisms about it, and just kind of how fundamentally off the mark they are, just in a very naive thinking or image of what energy is being used in the first place. And I agree, Bitcoin, I think, just gets picked on because it's obvious. It's just so clear what's being used. You know, we don't get to see, like, nobody tallies up, and, you know, there's no website calculator to show how many trillions of watts of electricity are used by prepackaged frozen meals. I mean, nobody gets to see that, right? Like, that's as hidden as you're gonna call them up, and nobody cares, nobody thinks about it. But Bitcoin, particularly when you have no idea what the hell proof of work is for, don't see any value in Bitcoin the asset, well, you just get these handy little numbers where you can make some kind of absurd assumptions and just do a math problem, and you get a point, and look at, like, how terrible this thing is that's using up all our energy. And it's just not that simple, and could very well, as I absolutely think, be a significant net positive on energy efficiency, innovation, and investment all around the world. All right, so let's close that here. Thank you guys so much for listening. A huge thank you to Nick Carter for this article. Always got some great stuff. I will have some links to previous articles that we have done with Nick Carter, of Nick Carter's, on the podcast. I don't even know how many we've done now. Oh, what do we got here? Let me do a little search. I've got 1 out of 11. These are all Nick Carter's. Yeah, need for user and internet. Cat is out of the bag. Transaction count is an inferior measure. A revolution. Oh my God, the most peaceful revolution. Such a good piece. That is still one of the absolute best. So many great ones to dig into. So if you haven't listened to Nick Carter's other pieces, man, I'm gonna have a lot of links in the show notes. So don't forget to check it out. Quick thank you to Hexa Wallet for supporting Bitcoin Audible and making all of this available to you and keeping me alive and fed and with coffee, so that I have the energy to go through all of this every day, all day. Hexa is an excellent mobile wallet, and it's really cool to see a lot of you guys testing it out and playing with it and starting to use it. Everybody's been DMing me, and I've added quite a number of contacts recently, so really cool to see y'all checking it out. It's a really great non-custodial wallet, privacy-preserving, multi-factor security, and a really clever seedless backup system. And they're making it better every day, so it is definitely one to check out. HexaWallet.io or HexaWallet on Twitter will get you there, and show them some love for supporting Bitcoin Audible. And if you would like to be in the elite class of Bitcoiners who support Bitcoin Audible, you can join my Patreon at patreon.com/thecryptoeconomy and come hang out with the Telegram crew, where we talk about all kinds of crazy stuff, and we talk about Bitcoin's energy consumption and how the government is poo-poo and all that great stuff. We are the Satoshi Audionauts, and we would love to have you join. Again, that is patreon.com/thecryptoeconomy, and a huge thank you to everyone who does support the show. It means everything. Thank you to my Audionauts fighting the good fight and helping to bring Bitcoin to the masses. And for those of you who cannot support financially, or, you know, need to hold on to those sats to protect your own future, the one thing you can always do to help this show is share it out with everybody you know in the Bitcoin space. And of course, now to your normies and people in crypto who are finally realizing that they may have made a terrible, terrible decision in all the shit coins. And to your normies who are finally looking at this thing again and being like, why does this keep going up? Point them to me and I'll tell them why. All right. I'll leave you with Nick Carter's final statement. I love how he ended this, is that, you know, at the end of the day, the energy consumption of Bitcoin is, it is our right to get the value out of what, like, if we think Bitcoin is providing us with immense value, assurances that nobody else can provide, and security and protection we or anyone else finds worth it to us, then it's our right to purchase it. You know, if you can put up Christmas lights and turn on more lights in the house than you need, or watch Netflix, or host a terrible blog that nobody wants to go to, or make phone calls for hours where you say nothing of value, well, then we get our Bitcoin and you can suck it. If, you know, if someone finds enough value in it to put their own resources to its creation and its use, then that's their right, period. It does not raise your electricity bill. It's not competing with my electricity. And in fact, if you were listening to the article, it could very possibly lower your electricity bill. So you know what? You're welcome. And as Nick said, all you got to do is devise a system that's more secure, offers stronger assurances, settles faster, is more privacy preserving, and more sensor resistant, all without using proof of work. And while you're figuring that out, subscribe to the show so you can get the best in Bitcoin made audible. I am out. Thank you for listening. And until next time, take it easy, guys. This has been a 111 production, and you were listening to Bitcoin Audible on the Crypto Economy Network.